Section 3, The Policies of Prosperity. An American Story. After Election Day 1920, President-elect Harding began searching for qualified Americans for his cabinet. One of the most important posts would be Secretary of the Treasury. The nation faced a large national debt, and many worried that the country would not easily pull out of its post-war recession. Harding was considering Andrew W. Mellon, a successful banker and industrialist, but he worried about Mellon's ties to industry and his relative anonymity. Harding's campaign manager, Harry Doherty, reassured the president with a ringing endorsement of Mellon. "A man who can quietly make the millions this modest-looking man has gathered in is little short of a magician. If there is one thing he knows, it's money. He will make for you the greatest Secretary of the Treasury since Alexander Hamilton." Adapted from Mellon's Millions. Promoting Prosperity. Harry Doherty's confidence in Andrew Mellon proved to be well-founded. Mellon became the chief architect of economic policy in the United States in the 1920s, and he served as Secretary of the Treasury in three successive Republican administrations. His policies encouraged growth and led to a stock market boom. Economics. The Mellon Program. Mellon firmly believed that the government should apply business principles to its operations. In 1921, he convinced Congress to create both the Bureau of the Budget to prepare a unified federal budget and the General Accounting Office to track government spending. When Mellon took office, he had three major goals: to balance the budget, to reduce the government's debt, and to cut taxes. He was convinced that these policies would promote economic growth and ensure prosperity. Mellon began by cutting government spending. The federal budget fell from $6.4 billion to less than $3 billion in 7 years. One major expense was the interest on the national debt. World War I costs had raised the debt from $5.7 billion in 1917 to almost $26 billion by 1920. Mellon refinanced the debt to lower the interest on it and persuaded the Federal Reserve to lower its interest rates as well. These steps, combined with increased tax revenue from the nation's economic boom, reduced the debt by $8 billion between 1921 and 1929. In addition to trimming government spending, Mellon focused on reducing tax rates. He believed that high taxes reduced the money available for private investment and prevented business expansion. Mellon further argued that high tax rates actually reduced the amount of tax money the government collected. If taxes were lower, businesses and consumers would spend and invest their extra money, causing the economy to grow. As the economy grew, Americans would earn more money, and the government would actually collect more taxes at a lower rate than it would if it kept tax rates high. This idea is known today as supply-side economics. At Mellon's urging, Congress dramatically reduced tax rates. When Mellon took office, most Americans paid 4% federal income tax, while wealthy Americans in the highest bracket paid 73%. By 1928, Congress had reduced the rate most Americans paid to 0.5% and cut the rate for the wealthiest Americans to 25%. Hoover's Cooperative Individualism. Mellon's program was only one part of the government's effort to promote economic growth. Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover also sought to promote economic stability in various industries. Hoover tried to balance government regulation with his own philosophy of cooperative individualism. This idea involved encouraging manufacturers and distributors to form their own trade associations, which would voluntarily share information with the federal government. Hoover believed this system would reduce costs and promote economic efficiency. To assist American businesses, Hoover also created several other agencies. He set up the Bureau of Foreign and Domestic Commerce to find new markets and business opportunities for American companies. He also established the Bureau of Aviation to regulate and support the airline industry, and the Federal Radio Commission, which set rules regarding the use of radio frequencies and the power of radio transmitters. Reading check. Evaluating. What government policies were intended to promote economic growth and improve business efficiency in the 1920s? Trade and arms control. Before World War I, the United States had owed billions of dollars more to foreign investors than foreigners owed to Americans. By the end of the war, the situation was reversed. Former wartime allies owed the United States more than $10 billion in war debts incurred for food and armaments. By the 1920s, the United States was the dominant economic power in the world. Its national income far greater than that of Britain, Germany, France, and Japan combined. This new power presented the United States with a unique diplomatic challenge. Isolationism. In his victory speech after the 1920 election, President Harding declared the issue of American involvement in the League of Nations deceased. The majority of Americans, tired of being entangled in the baffling, mutually hostile, and dangerous politics of Europe, favored isolationism. They simply wanted to be left alone to pursue prosperity. The United States, however, was too powerful, too economically interconnected with other countries, and too widely involved in international affairs to retreat into isolationism. American delegates participated in many League conferences. It was United States policy to promote peace through agreements with individual countries rather than doing so through the collective efforts of the League. The Dawes Plan. The United States' former wartime allies had difficulty making the payments on their immense war debts. They claimed that high American tariffs had closed the American market to their product and hampered their economic recovery. If they could not sell their products in the United States, they could not acquire the money they needed to pay off their war debts. They also argued that the United States should be willing to bear more of the financial burden because it had suffered far fewer wartime casualties than its allies. The United States government took the stance that American taxpayers should not be asked to assume the debts of others. American officials argued further that America's allies had gained new territory as a result of the victory over Germany, while the United States had gained nothing. These countries also were receiving reparations, huge cash payments Germany was required to make as punishment for starting the war and causing so much destruction. These payments, however, were completely crippling the German economy. It was vital for the United States that European economies be healthy so that the Europeans could buy American exports and repay their war debts. Thus, in 1924, Charles G. Dawes, an American banker and diplomat, negotiated an agreement with France, Britain, and Germany by which American banks would make loans to the Germans that would enable them to meet their reparations payments. At the same time, Britain and France would accept less in reparations and pay more on their war debts. Although well-intended, the Dawes Plan did little to ease Europe's economic problems. Britain, France, and Germany went through the motions of paying what they owed, while in fact going deeper into debt to American banks and corporations. The Washington Conference. Despite severe economic hardship, the major powers were involved in a costly post-war naval arms race. To help halt this arms race, the United States invited representatives from 8 major countries: Great Britain, France, Italy, China, Japan, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Portugal to Washington to discuss disarmament. The Washington Conference opened on November 12, 1921. In his address to the delegates, Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes proposed a 10-year moratorium, or pause, on the construction of major new warships. He also proposed a list of warships in each country's navy to be destroyed, beginning with some American battleships. The delegates cheered Hughes's speech and then entered into lengthy negotiations. Their efforts produced 3 agreements. In the 5-power Naval Limitation Treaty, Britain, France, Italy, Japan, and the United States essentially formalized Hughes's proposal. The four-power treaty between the United States, Japan, France, and Britain recognized each country's island possessions in the Pacific. Finally, all the participating countries signed the nine-power treaty, which guaranteed China's independence. As a long-term effort to prevent war, the conference had some serious shortcomings. It did nothing to limit land forces. It also angered the Japanese because it required Japan to maintain a smaller navy than either the United States or Great Britain. It did, however, give Americans cause to look forward to a period of peace, recovery, and prosperity. Abolishing war. The apparent success of the Washington Conference boosted the belief that written agreements could end war altogether. Perhaps the highest expression of that idea occurred when U.S. Secretary of State Frank Kellogg and French Foreign Minister Aristide Briand proposed a treaty to outlaw war. On August 27, 1928, the United States and 14 other nations signed the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Eventually, 62 nations ratified it. Though it had no binding force, the pact was hailed as a victory for peace. It stated that all signing nations agreed to abandon war and to settle all disputes by peaceful means. The Kellogg-Briand Pact and the Dawes Plan were perhaps the most notable foreign policy achievements of the Coolidge administration. Reading check. Identifying. Why did the Dawes Plan fail to ease Europe's economic problems? Critical thinking skill builder. Distinguishing fact from opinion. Why learn this skill? Imagine that you are watching two candidates for president debate the merits of the college loan program. One candidate says, "In my view, the college loan program must be reformed. 60% of students do not repay their loans on time." The other candidate says, "College costs are skyrocketing, but only 30% of students default on their loans for more than 1 year. I believe we should spend more money on this worthy program." How can you tell who or what to believe? First, you must learn to distinguish a fact from an opinion. Then you will be better prepared to evaluate the statements that other people make. Learning the skill. A fact is a statement that can be proven. In the example above, the statement, 60% of students do not repay their loans on time, may be a fact. By reviewing statistics on the number of student loan recipients who repay their loan, we can determine whether the statement is true or false. To identify potential facts, look for words and phrases indicating specific people, places, events, dates, amounts, or times. An opinion, on the other hand, expresses a personal belief, viewpoint, or emotion. Because opinions are subjective, we cannot prove or disprove them. In the example above, most statements by the candidates are opinions. To identify opinions, look for qualifying words and phrases, such as, "I think," "I believe," "probably," "seems to me," "may," "might," "could," "ought," "should," "in my judgment," and "in my view." Also, look for expressions of approval or disapproval, such as good, bad, poor, and satisfactory. Be aware of superlatives such as greatest, worst, finest, and best, and notice words with negative meanings and implications such as squander, contemptible, and disgrace. Also, identify generalizations such as none, every, always, and never. Practicing the skill. For each pair of statements below, determine which is a fact and which is an opinion. Give a reason for each of your choices. 1A. President Harding was born in Ohio in 1865. B. Harding later became the most scandalous president in United States history. 2A. Harding's administration suffered numerous public scandals, including the Teapot Dome scandal. B. Calvin Coolidge was probably disgusted with Harding's poor performance in the White House. 3. Harding stated that the United States needed to return to normalcy, but he did not do anything to help the country. B. Coolidge took over the White House after Harding's death and led the nation for the next several years. 4. A. Henry Ford significantly lowered the price of the automobile with his mass production methods. B. Ford's Model T was the most significant invention of the 20th century. Applying the skill. Distinguishing fact from opinion. In a newspaper, find a news article and an editorial on the same topic or issue. Identify 5 facts and 5 opinions from these sources. Glencoe's Skill Builder Interactive Workbook CD-ROM Level 2 provides instruction and practice in key social studies skills.